Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Donna Stair.
And I'm her husband, Alan. This is a week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch. We're getting into the music,
the trivia,
and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, don't touch that dial. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm at WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to the WKRP cast. Today we're trying to effect a change. What is our episode, Donna?
We are ready to discuss I Am Woman. The air date was February 21st, 1981. Written by Lisa Levin, story editor Lisa Levin, executive story consultant Dan Gunzelman and Steve Marshall, and it was directed by Linda Day. Mr. Carlson is notified the Flim Building, home of WKRP, is set to be torn down. The move is to make way for a modern office building. Bailey campaigns to have the building declared a landmark. Mr. Carlson's mama promises a better station will be built, so he campaigns against landmark status.
Those WKRP writers do love their titles. This one is stolen from the Helen Reddy female empowerment song of the same name. The song was written by Reddy in collaboration with Australian musician Ray Burton. Both have different memories as to how the song came about. Reddy says the lyrics came easily.
If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong.
Strong.
I am invincible.
Invincible.
I am woman.
Burton claims he rewrote much of Reddy's prose and turned her, quote, scribbling into a song. Reddy claims Burton didn't change a word. A first version was released on an album and appeared in a movie soundtrack. It didn't do much. Ultimately, Burton was forced to leave the U.S. due to work permit problems. It was after he left that a second recording of the song became a huge number one. Burton eventually sued for a cut of the royalties. I Am Woman became the first number one for an Australian-born artist and the first Australian-penned song to win a Grammy.
It's also ladies' night once again at WKRP. This time around, our female writer is story editor Lisa Levin. Also, back in the director's chair is Linda Day. Taking a look at shoot order, Linda is wasting no time getting into another episode. The episode Ask Jennifer, also directed by Linda, was shot the previous week. Normally, a director uses the week prior to shooting for production prep. Then, in the weeks after, they are involved in editing.
Let's get into the episode. We start out in the lobby. Jennifer is at her desk when Herb walks in, says good morning to Jennifer, and sits on the corner of her desk as he checks his mail. Jennifer asks, how his weekend was.
Pretty good. I took the kids to see that Walt Disney cartoon. Fantastic.
Fantasia.
Herb tells her there was no Goofy, Donald, Pluto.
And Mickey wasn't himself at all.
Well, you know mice.
You know mice.
Well, Fantasia was a groundbreaking 1940 American animated film released by Walt Disney Studios. It was only Disney's third animated feature. The Sorcerer's Apprentice segment began as a silly symphony short for Mickey Mouse. Mickey's popularity had faded by this time, and Walt was wanting to give him more exposure. The short became elaborate and expensive. The producers decided there was no way to make their money back on the short, so they expanded the concept to a feature film.
Fantasia consists of 8 animated segments set to classical music conducted by Leopold Stokowski. 7 of the 8 pieces were performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra. An entirely new multi-channel sound system called Fantasound was required to play the soundtrack. It severely limited where the movie could be shown. 13 cities across the U.S. were selected for the initial release. theaters in these cities were outfitted by Disney with the special equipment needed to play the soundtrack.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a production. Although it didn't turn a profit until 1969, Fantasia has gone on to become the 24th highest grossing film of all time in the United States, if you adjust for inflation. It's also considered the fifth greatest animated film ever made.
Les enters the lobby. Jennifer and Herb both greet him with a...
Good morning, Les.
Oh, hi, Les.
Herb asks him how his weekend was. After a long pause, Les answers...
Fine. What have you heard?
Herb tells Les he was just asking.
Well, I had my dog fixed. Phil? Phyllis.
Les removes his hat and places it over his heart as if giving respect to, Phyllis.
Now, hold on a minute. We don't want to spread this rumor that having your dog fixed changes their gender.
Right.
He's still Phil.
Still have the internal parts.
Yeah, the plumbing's the same.
Right.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye NewsHawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Right ring finger.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cob award-winning journalist Les Nessman. Bailey enters looking perky and ready for the day. Jennifer tells her good morning and asks about her weekend.
I marched 20 miles for the ERA.
Les asks Bailey why. Bailey explains it was to raise money. People donate so much per mile. Bailey walks over to Herb.
Herb, for instance, pledged $2 per mile.
What?
You did?
When?
Friday. I heard you.
Now, good luck getting that money out of Herb.
What?
Bailey mentions the ERA. This is the Equal Rights Amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment is a proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution designed to guarantee equal rights to all Americans, regardless of gender. It was designed to end the legal distinctions between men and women in areas like divorce, property, and employment. The ERA was first introduced to Congress in 1923. The first text of the amendment was written by Alice Paul and Crystal Eastman.
Early opponents to the ERA said, hold on a minute, women need special treatment in areas like working conditions or special hours. The amendment faded without being ratified. The rise of the women's movement in the 60s led to a reintroduction of the amendment in October of 1971. It was approved to go to ratification in the spring of 72. States were for it, legislators were for it. All that was needed was ratification by 38 states within 7 years, which is standard for an amendment. So they had to have it ratified before March 22nd of 1979. Enter conservative Phyllis Schlafly and her women's movement. Schlafly managed to block ratification with only 3 states left. During the period when this episode is airing, the ratification deadline had been extended until 1982. Even with the extension, the ERA has yet to be ratified, and we are almost at 100 years since it was introduced.
My goodness.
Quite a story, isn't it?
Herb tells Bailey and Jennifer he didn't make any such pledge. Jennifer says he did, right out here in the lobby.
After one of your many 3-martini lunches.
Herb puts his hand up to his head as if he is trying to recall.
Was that the ERA?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the National Rifle Association.
Herb walks away saying he's not paying.
And they're foreshadowing Herb's drinking problem. We're going to have more on that in just a couple of weeks.
Right.
We love that Herb confused the ERA with the NRA. The NRA, the National Rifle Association, was founded in 1871 to advance rifle marksmanship. They still work to teach firearm safety and competency, but these days, the NRA has become a prominent gun rights lobbying organization. The NRA currently has about 5.5 million members who are not shy about donating to the cause. Revenue in 2018 was in excess of $412 million.
Les is calculating what Herb owes Bailey and the ERA.
Let's see, $2 times 20, that's
Oh, golly. 2 times 20, carry the 10. It's...
Andy has entered the lobby, and he helps Les by telling him...
40 less.
Andy asks Jennifer for his mail.
As we saw in The Baby, Andy is once again in a sweatsuit and wearing a sweatband on his head. And again, with that hair... Andy cannot pull off a sweatband.
It kind of defeats the purpose of the sweatband when the hair's all stuffed down in there.
It's in the middle of his hair. It's kind of halfway up, and it is not a great look.
Jennifer smiles up at Andy and asks,
did you have another wild and woolly weekend?
As a matter of fact, I did. I grouted my bathtub.
And Andy asks Jennifer about her weekend.
And did you know Andy was the first to think about asking Jennifer about her weekend? She asked everybody else, but none of the others asked her how her weekend was.
It might be Andy's southern manners.
Right, his mama raised him right.
Jennifer tells them she went to a wonderful antique auction.
In this country?
Uh-huh, and I bought a spinning wheel.
I love it that Andy asks her if it was in this country, because with Jennifer, you never know.
No.
She was in Spain during Mr. Carlson's church auction.
So Bailey asked Jennifer how old this spinning wheel is. Jennifer tells them, circa 1814.
1814, which would put us right around the War of 1812.
And man, Les is into just ciphering stuff, isn't he?
The War of 1812 began in June of 1812 and lasted through February of 1815. The U.S. declared war on Britain in an attempt to end British maritime rights and continued British occupation in North America. If the Revolutionary War was the breakup, the War of 1812 was getting our stuff back. A fringe benefit to the war could mean the U.S. annexation of Canada.
We might get Canada in this war.
The Brits were backing indigenous tribes in North America and possibly even funding their raids on U.S. citizens.
As a part of the war, the U.S. also took on Spanish influence in Florida. Most of the fighting during the War of 1812 took place to the north and east or in the Deep South. British forces were able to push into Washington, D.C. and burn the White House in August of 1814. General Andrew Jackson came to national prominence when he defeated a British attack on New Orleans in early 1815.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British.
His celebrity after the war would eventually win him the presidency in 1828. When it was all over, treaties put things back to pretty much the way they were before the war. Only Spain's influence in Florida was greatly diminished.
And we didn't get Canada, eh?
No Canada. It went back to the same border as before.
Jennifer mentioned buying an antique spinning wheel. A spinning wheel is a machine designed to twist fibers into thread. A spinning wheel can create more uniform thread thickness than the old method of twisting by hand. Historians believe the first spinning wheels were invented in India sometime between 500 and 1000 AD. The earliest clear illustration of a spinning wheel was found in Baghdad, drawn in 1237. The earliest Chinese illustration dates to around 1270.
The foot treadle was added in 1533 by a German citizen from Brunswick in Lower Saxony. How important was the spinning wheel as a machine? It's said to have increased the production of thread by tenfold over the old hand method. Medieval historians claim the output from the spinning wheel led to greater supplies of rags, which in turn led to cheap paper. The spinning wheel then directly influenced the increased development of printing. By the late 1800s, spinning wheels were eliminated by spinning machines created during the Industrial Revolution.
Mr. Carlson comes into the lobby and he tells everyone good morning and asks Jennifer if there's any mail for him. Jennifer says there is and hands him an envelope.
Really?
Mr. Carlson is surprised. He looks the envelope over carefully.
It's going to be a great week for me. It even looks important.
Jennifer points at it and tells him it's registered.
Registered?
It's like he won the lottery.
Carlson turns and proudly looks at Andy, who is peering over his shoulder.
Hey, I got a registered letter.
Andy slaps Mr. Carlson on the back and asks who it's from.
Art says it's from the owner of the Flim building.
Mr. Flim?
Yeah, probably.
He begins to open the letter.
Dear Mr. Carlson, hi, how's it going? Just, you know. Oh, no. No, they're going to build a brand new office building.
Where?
Here, right where we're standing.
They're going to tear this building down?
Uh-huh. 3 months from now.
3 months from today?
Les squints his eyes and starts to calculate out loud.
3 months from today. Let's see, that's...
Now, we know Les is sometimes uninformed, but when did he get to be so dumb that he can't multiply 2 times 20 or figure 3 months into the future?
He's very foggy today. So as Les tries to figure how long they've got, we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
Come back to a bar setting. There's music playing, but it's so buried in the background, not even Michael Hernandez, the accountant of rock, was able to identify it. We find out that this is the bar area of the Cricket in the Flim building. Les picks up some bowls of snack mix. Andy is chatting up a cute girl at the bar.
Get my order, Andy.
Yeah, Les.
Thank you.
Les walks over to where 2 tables have been pushed together. We see Johnny, Herb, Venus, Mr. Carlson, Jennifer, and Bailey sitting around the tables enjoying drinks.
And there was no one in there I could identify with. I mean, not even Huey, Dewey, or Louie.
Herb is still dealing with his Fantasia experience. Ooh, and wow.
It's time.
Herb Darlick, fashion alert.
Herb is wearing tan pants with a plaid jacket containing shades of yellow, tan, brown, and green. The collar and pockets of the jacket match the color of his pants.
Venus tells Herb Fantasia is more than just another Disney cartoon.
It's a classic achievement in animation.
Yeah, stupid.
Johnny tells him he's seen Fantasia at least
2 dozen times, and every time I see different things.
Bailey leans over and gets in Johnny's face.
Do you ever take me?
No.
Now, Bailey has obviously had a few drinks, and she sounds like an angry drunk. She's being very confrontational. No surprise, Johnny is a Fantasia fan. Remember, he spent most of the episode under a desk during an acid flashback in Put Up or Shut Up. Fantasia is widely considered a psychedelic or drug movie with its dancing broomsticks and baby unicorns. It's ranked right up there with Clockwork Orange and Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Fantasia is even suggested, no joke, as a first watch for new acid droppers.
Hmm.
Yeah, if you're just starting out. You may have heard the rumor Walt Disney himself used acid as inspiration for the movie. That rumor has been widely discredited. For one thing, LSD didn't make its way to the U.S. until 1949, a good decade after the production of Fantasia. Now, if Walt and his gang of animators were on anything, it was probably booze.
Mr. Carlson is sitting next to Jennifer.
Boy, what a jam, what a mess, what a pickle, what a fix.
Carlson shakes his head as he munches on some of the snack mix.
I had my dog fixed.
Mr. Carlson tells Jennifer that he loves this building, and she tells him she does too.
Where do they get off tearing it down? Who are these people?
Bailey is a bit woozy and unsteady in her chair, and her hair is a mess. She looks like she's had too much.
Yeah.
Venus tells Bailey they own it.
What do they know?
Mr. Carlson tells them he bets Mama's gonna be mad. Moving into a new building will double their rent.
Maybe Mama will let you build your dream office building now, Mr. Carlson.
The one with the sauna?
Uh-huh.
Andy comes to the table with a tray of several drinks and mugs of beer.
You know, I've never seen this place as crowded. Every tenant in the building is down here, and I want to tell you, they're mad as hell, too.
Bailey tells him they ought to be.
Turning us out street.
Les asks, where will all the people go? What will they do?
Probably just what we're going to do, move into some vertical ice cube tray.
Bailey turns to Andy and loudly asks where her old fashion is. He tells her it's right there in front of her.
And isn't it here you pointed out that Les looks like he's got an ice cream sundae?
Yes, Les is enjoying an ice cream sundae as the others are having their drinks.
So Bailey's drinking an old fashioned. An old fashioned is considered the very first cocktail. It's made by muddling sugar with bitters and water, adding whiskey, either rye or bourbon, and garnishing with an orange slice and a cocktail cherry. It was made in what we would call a rocks glass. When it was first introduced, it was called an old-fashioned glass because there were no other cocktails. By the late 1900s, bartenders were getting experimental, adding all kinds of things to cocktails and creating new ones. The name came about when a patron wanted something simple. more like cocktails used to be. They would order an old-fashioned.
You ever had an old-fashioned?
No. Do you think I would like it?
You know, no. You know my taste. I don't think you would. An old-fashioned can almost take paint off of wood. It can be pretty strong. Oh. There's a lot of bourbon in an old-fashioned,
well,
usually.
You know me. I like my drinks sweet.
Yeah, it has the sugar in it, but not nearly enough to overcome the rye or bourbon. So Venus asks how old the building is.
Well, let's see. It was built in 1931, so that would make it
50, Les.
Les then begins telling everyone the hilarious history of the building and the Flim family.
As I recall, the Flim building was financed by the Flim firm, which was formed by Floyd Flim V, who inherited the Flim fortune from his father, Floyd Flim IV, whose forefather, Floyd I, was one of our city's founders. Interestingly enough...
Speak for yourself.
Interestingly enough, this building once housed one of Cincinnati's first radio stations and its most famous burlesque theater.
Andy picks up on the radio station part of the story.
A radio station?
Yes.
Hey, that's history.
But it was a different phrase that caught Herb's attention.
Burlesque theater? Why would they close that down?
Just like with Venus, the Flim building is 5 years younger than the actual Cincinnati Enquirer building. Okay, now wait a minute. What do you mean there when you say just like with Venus?
Well, when Venus said in one of the episodes that he was 30 years old, we looked it up, and during that episode, Tim Reed, the actor, was 35 years old.
I see where
so
you're going.
He was 5 years older than Venus, so the Cincinnati Enquirer building also lying about its age in this episode.
Okay, I didn't catch that. The building we see in establishing shots was completed in 1926, not 1931. It was designed by the American engineering firm of Lockwood, Green & Company in multiple architectural styles, not just Art Deco. The Cincinnati Enquirer building was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1975. It currently houses two 100-plus room hotels.
Herb keyed right in on burlesque in that little discussion there, and Herb is most likely reminiscing about burlesque from the 1920s. By then, most of burlesque was about the striptease. Burlesque in the U.S. can be traced all the way back to 1868 and the arrival of a troupe called Lydia Thompson's British Blondes. Prior to their arrival, the U.S. had seen some Victorian burlesques, things they called leg shows, and minstrel shows, but audiences for all of those were kind of fringe and seedy. The British Blondes' success signaled that burlesque could go mainstream. They were the number one attraction in New York for the 1868 and 69 theater season.
By the summer of 1869, burlesque backlash was in full swing. The New York Times called the attraction a disgrace. This did not stop entrepreneurs from taking it on the road. The first burlesque troupes, featuring lowbrow humor and scantily clad women, took to U.S. cities starting in 1870. By the 1880s, dozens of troupes were working various circuits throughout the country. Burlesque began by lampooning the upper classes and high art, like opera. By the 1920s, burlesque was all about low humor and naked women. The Great Depression, puritanical attitudes, and more nudity in movie theaters spelled the beginning of the end for burlesque. By the end of the 1960s, burlesque was no more.
Art shares a hilarious memory with them about when he snuck into the burlesque theater as a kid.
To see Sheila Bombs Away Morgan do her famous B-29 number.
Carlson spreads his arms out to each side.
Put her arms out like an airplane and then started to...
He then begins to shimmy his upper body. Jennifer is looking very uncomfortable sitting right next to him. Art brings his arms back in, realizing he may have gone too far. He quietly adds...
She looked like an airplane.
Now, although performers like Sheila were definitely a part of burlesque, we couldn't find a real Sheila Bombs Away Morgan. Also, Sheila may not have been historically accurate. The Boeing B-29 Flying Fortress had four engines, not two. As if anybody really cared.
Yeah.
We don't know what size her engines were.
So. Yeah.
Well, Bailey gets a look of hope on her face.
This building is a Cincinnati landmark. You cannot tear down a landmark.
Mr. Carlson agrees with Bailey, saying, hey, it is a landmark. Bailey's ready to organize a campaign to save the phlegm.
Come on. We're a radio station, aren't we? Let's get the show on the road. More drinks, man.
Bailey bangs her fist on the table. Johnny explains to Bailey why her idea won't work.
Listen, Bailey, there's a lot of money at stake here. You know, it's powerful people, it's big business. They don't look right.
I have big business for lunch.
Bailey is looking at Johnny with a determined, stubborn expression and the crazy eyes of someone who's had too many old fashions.
She's got the crazy eyes. Johnny tries to continue, but the wheels in Bailey's head are turning.
We need a plan. We need to organize.
Bailey's right.
Bailey is drunk.
Art's convinced.
Listen, Travis, we got here a historical building of historical consequence, and I want you to know that I'm putting all of my weight behind the lady from Chicago.
Bailey thanks Mr. Carlson, leaning towards Venus very unsteadily. Bailey kind of demands.
Now I ask you, what do we do?
You speaking to me?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I guess we could promote the signing of petitions, that kind of thing.
Bailey thanks Venus, calling him Trap, then addresses the group asking what else they could do.
I could begin to illuminate this issue in my news reports.
Bailey's getting fired up.
What else?
Carlson says he will give some editorials.
And I'll type those editorials.
Yeah.
Mr. Carlson looks at Jennifer.
Hey, Johnny?
Johnny is still not so sure this is a good idea.
This is real estate mega bucks here. It's big business.
I'm not afraid of big business.
Boy, I am.
I say let's get on the stick. I say let's save this building right now. Come on, everybody up on their feet. I say we go back up to the office and...
Pass out.
No.
Let's hit it.
Wow, you know how we've been seeing a lot of boom shadows since we moved over to MTM? At the end of this scene, don't miss the shot of an actual mic right above Bailey's head. The camera widened out early, anticipating her standing up. The mic didn't get out of the way in time. You can see it there for a good couple of seconds.
Andy, Bailey, Venus, Les, Art, and Jennifer all get up from the table and begin walking to the door. They are shouting inspirational phrases as they file out of the bar.
United we stand, divided we fall.
Yeah, Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
I am woman.
We shall overcome.
Sink ships.
How about we have not yet begun the fight?
Diamonds are our girl's best friend.
The exit slogans caused our ears to smoke. We had to dig into these great phrases at least a little bit. Check it out. United We Stand was a common American slogan, but it also became a pop song in 1970 for the Brotherhood of Man. It would peak at number 13 on the U.S. Hot 100.
Tippecanoe and Tyler too. This was also a song. It was written in 1840 using the music of a minstrel song called Little Pigs. The new lyrics, written by Zanesville, Ohio jeweler Alexander Kaufman Ross, sang the praises of 1840 presidential Whig candidates William Henry Tippecanoe Harrison and his running mate, John Tyler.
Oh, who has heard the great commotion, motion, motion all the country through? It is the ball a-rolling on for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with them will beat little Van, Van, Van is a used-up man. And with them will beat little Van.
It also took shots at Democratic candidate Martin Van Buren. Reviewers and political pundits of the time said the power of the song literally sang Harrison into the presidency. It was raucous, rousing, and fun. Today, the slogan Tippecanoe and Tyler too is better remembered than the song.
Bailey shouts, I am woman, which is the Helen Reddy number one hit we've already talked about and the title of this episode.
I am woman.
Venus chose We Shall Overcome. for a powerful slogan, and it's another song. We Shall Overcome is a gospel song, which became a protest song and key anthem of the American Civil Rights Movement. It was first sung in its current form by Charleston, South Carolina tobacco workers in 1945. Folk performers like Pete Seeger began to include it in their live shows.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. So
by 1959, Seeger's version was an unofficial anthem for the nonviolent civil rights protesters.
Loose lips sink ships was Les's phrase. This is not a song, but it did come from World War II. It was created by the War Advertising Council and used on posters by the U.S. Office of War Information. It's not really motivational. The catchy alliteration meant unguarded talk can be dangerous. Be careful of what you say and who you say it to.
We've not yet begun to fight was Art's phrase, also not a song. It is a quote originally attributed to Revolutionary War hero and father of the U.S. Navy, John Paul Jones.
And finally, Jennifer's Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend is another song. This one was originally introduced to the world by Carol Channing in the original 1949 Broadway production of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. The best-known performance comes from Marilyn Monroe in her 1953 film version of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Tiffany's.
Monroe's performance of Diamonds is considered iconic. It was voted the 12th best film song of the century. Lyrics by Leo Robin and music by Julie Stein.
Now let's take a look at Venus's vibin' threads. Venus is wearing a satin-looking sky blue shirt with dark blue horizontal lines beginning at his shoulders and diminishing in size as they go down his back and down his chest. He is also wearing matching sky blue pants that have many pockets, kind of like painter's pants. Johnny and Herb are left sitting at the table. Johnny had nabbed Venus's barely touched beer when the gang left, and he now takes one last swig from the mug and stands up. Herb puts his hand on Johnny's arm.
You're not going to go with them, are you?
Sure.
Herb asks why. Johnny puts his hand on Herb's shoulder and leans down.
The intelligent man always fights for the lost cause, realizing all others are merely effects.
Herb is confused.
What? E.E. Cummings.
Johnny says as he nods his head at Herb. Then he walks out.
We couldn't find a date, but this quote is widely attributed to E.E. Cummings. It simply means lost causes are the only causes truly worth fighting for.
E.E. Cummings.
Herb is left alone at the table.
Obviously, I'm the only one smart enough around here to sit tight.
Looking smug, Herb takes a drink from his glass. A waitress lays the bill down in front of him. Oops, that's what you get for sitting tight. Herb sets his drink down and looks it over. Very calmly, he takes a pencil out of the inside pocket of his jacket, glances around, then begins erasing things from the bill.
He'll have that down to like $5
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, he's going to get it down cheap. We had a ton of background folks in this scene and not a single credit for any one of them. Although we're probably looking at writers and production people, many of the background players look like something out of Central Casting. It's like they called up and said, give us generic office workers at a bar.
Now, the next scene takes place in the studio, but before we begin, we need to look at a quick poster watch.
Yay!
We already discussed Black Market Clash during Jennifer's show, but we saw something new.
In the lower right corner of the screen, down by Les's elbow, is a promo poster for Rod Stewart's 1980 album, Foolish Behavior. It was his 10th studio album, released November 21st of 1980. This one had five single releases. The biggest by far was Passion.
My
The single Passion was in the top 20 on charts around the world, and most places it hit in the top 10. Passion peaked at number 5 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 and number 2 in Canada.
Under the Window, where we've been seeing Huey Lewis, is now a poster for the Todd Rundgren album Healing. This was Rundgren's 9th studio album, and it had just come out in January of 1981. No U.S. singles, but the album will go to number 48 on the U.S. album chart. And what a weird time this was for music formats. Healing was originally released on vinyl, cassette, and 8-track. It will also get a CD re-release. 8-track. I had an 8-track tape player.
The tons and tons of plastic that was sold in the name of getting music to people. In the studio, Les is at the microphone reading from his yellow tear sheets.
And finally in Cincinnati, tragedy strikes. This reporter has just learned that yet another senseless high-rise will malign our fair city skyline. According to this reporter, the fabulous Flynn Building, a veritable downtown landmark, has been targeted for destruction, leaving hundreds homeless. Quoting Benjamin Disraeli, when a people forget their own history...
Les flips the paper over, but he cannot find the rest of the quote.
They're in big trouble, boy.
That's probably not the rest of the quote.
Les mentioned the name Benjamin Disraeli. Benjamin Disraeli is a very quotable guy, but we don't think he said anything like, when a people forget their own history. We did a backtrack on the quote, and the only place you can find it as a phrase is in the captioning for this episode.
Benjamin Disraeli is the first and, to date, only Jewish person to have become Prime Minister of Britain. Disraeli was born in 1804 in London. He was a politician and writer. Disraeli is credited with laying the foundations for what is now known as the Conservative Party. He's also credited with beginning the One Nation conservatism that went on to become the dominant political choice of Great Britain for decades. He became prime minister in 1868 and then again in 1874. Both of his terms were under Queen Victoria. He was also a published author, and he is known for many famous quotes, just not the one Les is claiming. He died in 1881 at the age of 76.
On history, we did find him saying, "What we learn from history is that we do not learn from history." Other quotable Disraeli, "When I want to read a good book, I write one."
Justice is truth in action.
Talk to a man about himself, and he will listen for hours.
There are three kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Little things affect little minds.
We cut into the production studio, and we're kind of doing a montage here between the main studio and the production studio. Art and Bailey are about to record in production, but before they do, we've got another poster watch in the background.
Yay!
We've got a Warren Zevon poster. That poster right there between Art and Bailey is promoting Warren Zevon's live album, Stand in the Fire. It was released in December of 1980. It was recorded at West Hollywood's Roxy Theater in August of 1980. The album included two new original songs, including the title track.
Stand in the Fire.
Mr. Carlson are in the production studio. Bailey is wearing headphones and Mr. Carlson is standing behind a microphone. We see a large 2-track reel-to-reel tape recorder running just behind Bailey.
Carlson editorial, take one.
I really like Cincinnati. It's been good to me.
Huh?
Yeah, but I feel like I want to pay it back.
No? Well, you should. Carlson editorial, take 2.
Should I go now?
Bailey whimpers.
We're doing kind of a quick edit back and forth between the studio and the production studio, much like Ian asked Jennifer, also directed by Linda Day. So back in the studio now, Johnny is at the mic.
That's right. The home of the mighty KRP is scheduled for demolition. Now, this place should be a landmark for a lot of reasons. And I want to ask you, are you going to take something like this lying down? Or are you going to take it standing up? Or in a crouched position?
We hear "What'd I Say" by Ray Charles playing in the background of Johnny's talk bit.
It was his breakthrough to the mainstream and is even credited with creating the subgenre known as soul. The song came about one evening after Charles and his band had gone through their entire set list, but they had promised to fill a certain amount of time. He improvised the song to fill time.
See the girl with the red dress on. She can do the burlap all night long. Yeah, yeah. What I say?
It went over so well with the live audience, he told his manager he wanted to record it. Released in June of 1959, What I Say would peak at number 6 on the Hot 100, and it earned Charles his first gold record. It would also become the closer to his live shows for the rest of his career.
Again, we are in the production studio where Bailey is sticking it out with Mr. Carlson.
Carlson editorial, take 3, rolling.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready now.
Okay.
We cut to a long shot, an exterior of Cincinnati at night, as we hear Venus's voice going out over the airwaves. He's calling for people to sign petitions and receive a free Save the Flim t-shirt.
Here's another flash on a flim, that endangered species I like to call Art Deco. At last count, we had over 200 calls for petition forms, and that means 200 free Save the Flim t-shirts. Now we're talking two-color dye transfer pre-shrunk, Flim fans. So for all you dudes who dig Deco, start dialing.
The cut playing behind Venus is called Happy Robots by Jean-Luc Ponty. Ponty was a French jazz fusion artist. He was a producer who played violin, keyboard, and synth bass. This cut comes from his September 1980 release, Civilized Evil.
And we're back in the production studio, where a flustered Bailey is now losing her patience.
Carlson, editorial, take 40.
I really like what we're doing.
Huh? Me too. It's fun.
Yeah, we're thinking they went on way too long with this one. Besides, we saw Art doing some recording in Carlson for President. He might not be a pro, but we know he knows his way around the production studio. We transition to the lobby where we hear sounds of a typewriter clacking away as Mr. Carlson comes out of his office. He's wearing his hat and his overcoat is draped over his arm. He walks up behind Jennifer, who is typing at what sounds like 150 words per minute.
This shouldn't become, a habit, should it?
Jennifer ignores Mr. Carlson and continues typing.
I suppose not.
So we were curious about typing speed. The fastest speed ever recorded for an English language typist was notched by American Barbara Blackburn, who hit 216 words per minute.
Woo!
Yeah, we found a clip of Barbara typing on David Letterman. Check it out. This is world champion Barbara. And this is WKRP's Jennifer.
This shouldn't become, a habit, should it?
Quite possibly, Jennifer should have gone pro.
216 words per minute.
Yes, world record still stands.
Jennifer continues typing at lightning speed as Herb enters. He quickly walks up behind Jennifer and slips a couple of sheets of paper on her desk. Jennifer stops typing, picks up the papers, and asks Herb what they are.
Nothing, just a couple of letters that need typing, single-spaced and triplicate.
Jennifer asks Herb if they concern the Flim campaign.
Yeah, sure.
I don't see Bailey's approval.
It was verbal.
I'll just call her.
Herb tells Jennifer, sure, go ahead and call.
Jennifer picks up the phone and dials. Herb quickly races to the phone and hits the disconnect button. She called his bluff.
Not everything around here concerns that stupid campaign. This is a place of business.
Jennifer tells him to type his own letters.
Nowhere in my job description does it say that I have to type.
Same here.
Jennifer is smiling up at Herb. Herb looks at Jennifer.
I thought you were a secretary.
I am a receptionist. Receptionists receive. They offer comfort, provide support, answer a few phone calls, but they do not type, unless it's for a very good cause.
Oh, receptionists receive.
Yes.
I see.
The phone rings and Jennifer answers.
Save the flim.
Jennifer is listening to the person on the other end as Bailey enters, puts some things on Jennifer's desk, and heads back toward the bullpen.
Now, hold on a minute. Bailey just entered from the main doors of the lobby. She was coming in from the outside. So speaking of a bluff, Jennifer, earlier when she was calling Bailey, was bluffing Herb.
Right. She was not back there in that bullpen.
No, she wasn't at her desk.
Herb follows Bailey as he talks.
Bailey, I'd like your approval on something.
Oh, not now, Herb.
Now, Bailey.
Jennifer speaks to the caller.
No, I don't think it's necessary for you to chain yourself to the building just yet. Well, if that's what you want to do, okay.
Jennifer hangs up the phone, stretches her fingers, wiggles them, and then goes back to typing at incredible lightning speed.
We cut into Andy's office and check out the bumper sticker wall.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing wall of bumper stickers has grown since we were last in Andy's office during Venus and the Man. Word is spreading and the bumper stickers are flooding in. In other big programming news, someone finally caught the misspelling of the word programming on Andy's office door. It now has two M's.
I know that was really bothering you.
It was bugging me.
Les and Venus are sitting on the couch, and Andy is standing behind them looking at some paperwork. Venus is reading the newspaper.
Now, let's take a look at Venus's vibin' threads.
Venus is wearing a solid purple jumpsuit, pant legs tucked into shiny black knee-high boots. He has a thin gray striped scarf under the collar of the shirt, and a gold chain necklace around his neck. And we've seen those black knee-high boots before. They're kind of folded over at the top.
His Captain Morgan boots.
Yeah. Well, or like the one that Puss in Boots wore.
Oh, yeah.
Herb enters, slamming the door.
Andy?
You.
Bailey struck me.
Travis turns to look at Herb. Herb corrects himself and then goes on.
She didn't strike me, but she bumped into me. Then threatened to set the whole city on fire by setting matches to my suit.
Les, Venus, and Andy all laugh. Herb blames Andy for putting Bailey in charge of the Save the Flim business. Herb says she's out of control.
I mean, she's a little Hitler, you know what I'm saying?
Hey, we've got a programming office poster watch.
Yay!
Although Andy's office is now primarily the bumper sticker shrine, which it's taking over the whole set, we do still get a couple of music posters like Fleetwood Mac's Live to the left of Andy's desk. You can see a poster for Fleetwood Mac's 1980 live album. This was a double-length disc released December 8th, just in time for Christmas of 1980. Most of the songs were recorded on the previous year's Tusk tour, but a few of them were also from the Rumors tour and elsewhere.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please give a warm welcome to Fleetwood Mac?
One, at least, the new Stevie Nicks song Fireflies, appears to have been a studio demo where they added crowd noise to make it sound live. Amazingly, this is the first of 9 live albums eventually released by Fleetwood Mac. It peaked number 14 on the U.S. album chart.
Up high above Andy's desk is a banner for the Manfred Mann's Earth Band album, Chance. It came out the 10th of October of 1980. The Bruce Springsteen-written song, For You, was released as a single. They'd had big hits with Springsteen's Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night. Well, this one didn't do as well. The album hit number 42 in Australia, and that was it. No other chart action anywhere else in the world.
And again,
yes, it's time.
Herb Darlick, fashion alert.
Herb has on a bright blue plaid three-piece suit. Everything is plaid, with a white dress shirt and a shades of blue diagonally striped tie. We can't see them, but we can assume he's wearing those white shoes.
The door opens and Bailey comes into Andy's office. She asks Herb if he ordered those petitions.
No. What do you think of that?
Ooh.
Andy, do you have any matches?
All right.
Andy looks under a pile of papers and finds a matchbook. Andy, who does not smoke, we've never seen him smoke in the station.
I don't think I've seen anybody smoke.
Nobody smokes in the station, just happens to have a matchbook right there on his desk, and he hands them to Bailey. Bailey turns to Herb, removing a match as she walks towards him. She strikes the match and tosses it at him as he is speaking.
Where do you think you get off being in charge of this whole thing anyway, huh? I mean, go ahead. Answer. Come on.
And the match gag is hilarious.
It is a riot.
Not only is it impressive that Jan Smithers can keep throwing lit matches, but the Frank Bonner is doing lines while having lit matches hit him.
He just keeps going.
Speak up, Venus. Come on, tell her. I mean, in fact, I think I'd like to move into one of these new buildings. You know, all that steel and glass turns me off.
Bailey continues striking matches and tossing them at a Herb. I love this so much. She's totally ignoring what he's saying. Herb jumps back as each match hits him.
All right, I'll order your petitions.
Herb hurries out of the door finally. He's beaten down. He slams it shut behind him to get away.
Smiling, Bailey hands the matchbook back to Andy. Now, if Johnny had handed her the matchbook, that wouldn't be so weird.
You'd have believed that
one. Yeah.
Interesting management concept.
Venus and Les are smiling as Bailey walks to the door. She asks where Mr. Carlson is.
He went to see his mama.
Before leaving, Bailey gives some verbal instructions to Venus and Les.
Venus, mention the building tonight?
You got it.
Les, keep hitting the flim with your broadcasts.
Sure.
Bailey's really taking control of this project, and you can see she's very excited. She leaves the office. Venus, a grin on his face, looks at Les.
Boy, I love when he's all kicked up about something, huh?
She's always onto something.
Yeah.
Whales, or baby seals, or pollution, or nuclear waste. You know, nuclear waste is a particularly interesting subject. Here we are creating this highly dangerous material that has a life of 500 to 5 million years, and we only know how to store it for 20 years or so.
Venus is no longer smiling, but Les is giggling with excitement as he continues.
It keeps building up more and more of it all the time. And nobody, I mean nobody, knows what to do with it.
Is that true?
Yeah.
He gets so excited talking about this.
Oh, he is. He's giddy. We're sorry to say Les is still very right about the problems of nuclear waste storage and disposal. As of 2020, more than 250,000 metric tons of highly radioactive nuclear waste are being stored throughout the world. 90,000 tons are in the U.S. alone. Storage sites are degrading and leaking. Geologic repositories built anywhere from 500 to 1,000 meters below ground are widely considered the best way to store the waste long term. Unfortunately, even though geologic repositories are hailed as the answer, scientists disagree as to how exactly these repositories should be built and how safe they're really going to be when it comes to centuries of storage. It's 40 years later and still...
Nobody knows what to do with it.
Well, that's scary.
It is, but it's true.
The door to Andy's office opens and Mr. Carlson comes in with a tube of rolled up papers. He excitedly walks over to Andy's desk, unrolling them.
Just went over to see Mother about the rents going up, and guess what?
What?
We're going to build my dream building.
Andy stands up from his chair.
Lease cars, own property. That's what Mother always said, so we're going to go through with it.
Art puts the papers showing the plans for the new building on Andy's desk.
Take a look at this. The WKRP building.
Hit my dream come true.
Hey.
Andy slaps Art in the back and bends down to get a closer look at the plans. Art looks over at Les.
You know what this means, don't you, Les?
What?
That means you're going to have walls.
I get walls? Oh, Venus!
Man, he knows Les's hot button. Les wraps his arms around Venus's neck, pulling him close. Les sees the expression on Venus's face and decides he'd better loosen his embrace, and he slides away from Venus, leaving a generous space between them.
He was just so excited. His walls. Carlson continues giving Andy a tour of the new building plans.
And Travis, you're going to have your own big private office with a record library. And in my private office, I've got a secret entrance there, see?
Andy's nodding and smiling. Turning to Venus, Carlson tells him there will also be a room for disc jockeys.
Where you can just sit and do whatever disc jockeys do.
Carlson is like a kid on Christmas morning.
Of course, Jennifer can have whatever she wants. This is my dream come true.
The door to Andy's office opens and Bailey comes in. And you remember how motivated she was? That's how motivated Art is about this new building.
Mr. Carlson, are you excited?
Yes, Bailey.
Well, let's get going on editorial number two. Come on.
Bailey turns and leaves, closing the door. And suddenly we see the smile melt from Art's face. He realizes what he's just said. He picks up the plans from Andy's desk.
Editorial number two.
In the lobby, Jennifer's sitting at her desk looking at some papers when Bailey walks in, her head hanging low, a defeated expression on her face. Jennifer says good morning and asks how her evening was. Bailey does not answer as she looks through the messages on Jennifer's desk. Jennifer tries to talk to Bailey.
Oh, Bailey, try to understand. Mr. Carlson...
Bailey interrupts Jennifer, holding up some pieces of paper. She asks what all of these are.
Well, they're phone messages from people who want to help save the Flynn building.
Bailey plops them back onto Jennifer's desk.
The door to Carlson's office opens and Art comes out asking if Bailey is in yet. He looks up and sees Bailey and rushes over to her.
Bailey, listen, try and understand.
No, Mr. Carlson, I do not want to understand. Now, I know you're a good man. And that you have your reasons.
Art appeals to Bailey.
Bailey, listen. Who knows if Mama's going to want to build the Carlson Plaza 5 years from now or not. I got to strike while she's hot.
Bailey tells Carlson it's all right.
Mr. Carlson goes on to tell her this is his dream building. He tells her he didn't think he was going to get this thing built until the turn of the century. Bailey looks at Carlson with pleading eyes.
But can't we save the Flynn building too?
Carlson looks at Bailey. You can see he feels awful.
You see, if we do that, then we don't have to move. And if we don't, I mean, I can't have...
Carlson is struggling.
I understand.
Bailey heads out of the lobby to the bullpen. Carlson goes over to Jennifer. Jennifer looks up at him with a sad face.
She understands.
We cut into the studio where Johnny's at the mic introducing who'll be the next in line by the Sir Douglas Quintet when Bailey comes in.
Here's another powerhouse band from the 60s. They're back. They're reformed. They got a new record out. It's the Sir Douglas Quintet. Texas rock and roll.
The Sir Douglas Quintet was formed in 1964 by Texan Doug Somm. The quintet was influenced by local Texas R&B, but they also allowed some of the British invasion sound to seep into their work. The 60s version of the quintet were the guys who really scored big. They had 1965, She's About a Mover.
Whoa, yeah, what I say.
They had a total of 4 Hot 100 hits that would all happen in the 60s. This cut, Who'll Be the Next in Line, is a 1981 cover of a Kinks tune. This was supposed to be a resurgence for Sir Douglas.
Who'll be the next in line? Who'll be the next to watch you love me? Who'll make the same mistakes I made over you?
The surge never materialized. The quintet has continuously released albums for decades. They usually repackage older recordings. Most recently, they came out with a live album in 2018. The performance on it was from a 1981 Austin City Limits show.
Bailey sits on the stool in the studio. Johnny asks her how it's going. Bailey tells him she's a little mad.
Just a little.
Yeah, we were finally going to do something of substance around here.
Johnny is putting albums into sleeves as he tells Bailey.
Come on, Bailey. All we were doing is blowing smoke up our noses.
No, we weren't.
Bailey disagrees with him. She tells him it could have worked.
I don't think so.
Why not?
Because you can't beat the system, sweetheart. I mean, take it from me.
Bailey tells Johnny, you can beat the system. Johnny tells Bailey, just forget it. Bailey says she can't forget it.
Okay, don't forget it. Get real mad about it. Develop an ulcer. That'll be helpful.
I like ulcers.
Fine.
Bailey heads over to the cart. She wants to find Carlson's editorial. Johnny jumps up.
Now, get serious,
where
Bailey.
Is it?
Forget it. I'm not going to let you do this. Go on.
Bailey starts to leave. Then, suddenly, she remembers why she came in the first place.
Mm-hmm. You have a phone call on the bullpen phone.
Sure I do.
She said her name was Baby.
Johnny's not believing any of this.
And that she has a boat.
Boat?
Yeah, twin engine inboard.
Twins?
She said she really likes listening to your show, and she wants to know if you like cut-off jeans, skinny dipping, and getting weird.
Johnny's staring at her now. Bailey tells him, oh, it's true. She's on the phone, really.
Okay, so Bailey and Johnny have hit some new relationship plateau. How does she know his exact list of turn-ons?
It's very specific.
Well, she ticked those right off without even thinking hard about it. This is going beyond mere friends. Johnny can't risk it. What if she's telling the truth? He puts the album down, and as he heads to the door, he gives Bailey instructions.
B-side, third track, just a crossfade. I'll be gone for just a minute. It sounds like a coded message for help.
He's heading out there. He's going to that
coded
phone.
Coded message for help.
Johnny leaves. Bailey quickly turns to the carts, pulls out the one she was looking for, and puts it into the board. Turning some knobs, she fades out the song, and she begins Carlson's editorial.
What is a landmark? Hi, this is Arthur Carlson, general manager of WKRP, speaking on behalf of the entire station.
Our next scene, we transition into Carlson's office. We find out it's a cut for time. The editorial has been played, and they're feeling the after effects. Andy's leaning against the credenza as Mr. Carlson punches the wall, then kicks it. Andy asks him if he's mad.
Mad? Oh, no, I'm not mad. Of course, I talked with Bailey's father, and he said I could shoot her.
Even if he's joking about talking to Bailey's father, isn't it a little weird he would even mention her father?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would he mention calling Andy's dad if Andy screwed something up? Probably not. Art's treatment of Bailey as a daughter can be a little demeaning sometimes.
So Andy tells Art to relax.
If one more person tells me that, they get fired. I mean, right off the premises.
And boy, you saw the setup on that, didn't you? Art gives Andy a very stern look. The door opens, and Jennifer enters carrying a silver tray with a Tilvers C set on it.
I want to see that.
Yes. The door opens and Jennifer enters carrying a silver tray with a silver tea set on it.
Mr. Carlson?
Yeah, what?
Try to relax.
Yeah, there it is. Jennifer walks over to Carlson's desk. Carlson picks up the plans for the new building so that Jennifer can set the tray down. She tells Andy and Mr. Carlson that Bailey is on her way up. She begins pouring tea into the cups. Carlson tells them he will not accept her apology.
If you don't, I'll quit.
Right away, I think I'll mull it over in my mind here.
I love how Art did that U-turn there. Bailey enters without knocking and announces...
Mr. Carlson, I am not going to apologize.
Well, why not?
You want to fire me? Please do.
Art tells her he doesn't want to fire her.
I want to shoot you, of course, but I don't want to fire you. Firing's not even by my style, is it, Travis?
Oh, you're right, Mr. Carlson. And before I go, well, gosh darn it, I'd just like to sing all of you a little song. Pack up all your cares and more.
Here I knock it off, Travis. This is no time to be kidding around.
Andy went classic with his choice of tunes. Bye Bye Blackbird was written in 1926. It was first recorded by Sam Lannon's Dance Orchestra in March of 1926. It is considered a popular standard. Both Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney have recorded versions. McCartney said it was one of the many standards he remembers singing with his family.
I pack up all my cares and woe. Here I go, singing low. Bye-bye, Blackbird.
Bye Bye Blackbird was the number 16 song of 1926, according to website Pop Culture Madness. Ray Henderson composed the music, lyrics by Mort Dixon.
Jennifer had a good laugh, but Art didn't find it a bit funny.
Knock it off, Travis. This is no time to be kidding around. Can't you be serious? I'm trying to be serious here. Look, both you and Jennifer, just sit down over there. Are we going to try to act like a couple of adults?
I'm game.
Why not?
The two of them walk over to the couch, sit with their hands folded in their laps. They're game. They'll give it a try. They're looking at Art.
They look like they've been sent to the principal's office. Mr. Carlson gives Andy and Jennifer a serious that's enough look. He then turns his attention to Bailey.
This is for you, young lady. Sure, I like this building. Sure, I'd like to save it. But what about these, huh? What about these plans? What am I supposed to do for these? This Flynn building is just another one of your causes, isn't it? Huh? Huh? Come on, tell me the truth.
Yes.
Aha, you see? And just why should I put forth 1 ounce of effort? Just why in this world should I contribute anything to saving this heap of bricks?
Art Deco was just about the last architectural style in which humanistic design and fine craftsmanship were valuable considerations. After that came the glass and steel box. Originally, it was considered an art form, but it caught on mainly because it was cheaper to hang curtains of glass and have load-bearing walls. The machine was the metaphor for these constructions. The machine was in, people were out. Space became more important than the place. Singularity of design replaced variety, which, of course, is the very essence of life. Do you understand what I'm saying, Mr. Carlson?
Bailey is looking at Mr. Carlson for a response.
Art's just standing there, hands in his pockets, brow furrowed. He's trying to decipher what Bailey's just said. There's a long pause.
Yeah. And I'm sorry I asked. Thanks for stopping by.
Bailey tells him it was her pleasure, then turns and leaves the office.
Back in the bullpen, we see Herb and Bailey sitting at their desks working, and we hear Les's voice.
I'd like to personally thank you for postponing Mr. Carlson's dream building to the year 2000, and perhaps banishing for time immemorial my chance for walls.
Les has come out of his office, and he closes the door behind him.
Look at your walls, Les. I'm the lost cause lady, remember? Solar energy, the whales, ERA. Let's just talk about the ERA for a second, why don't we?
I'll give you $40 not to.
Herb gets up from his desk and walks over to Bailey, handing her $40. Herb tells her not to tell anybody where it came from. I'm surprised he gave that $40 to her, you know?
Just to shut her up. That's all he's doing.
Yeah, true.
And we've got another one.
It's time.
Herb Darlick, fashion alert.
Herb is wearing a white dress shirt with a red tie that matches his red pants. He's wearing a shades of gray plaid jacket with a black velvet pad on the right shoulder and black velvet elbow pads and his white shoes.
Herb and Les are getting their coats from the rack, ready to leave for the day. Herb tells Bailey he doesn't understand how she didn't get fired.
If I said no to the big guy, I'd be gone in a minute.
The threshold of your termination is much lower, Herb.
And that right there, honorable mention for line of the episode. That's a good one. Les and Herb leave the bullpen as Johnny enters from the studio hallway, slamming the door, which brings us to
the line of the episode.
You have any idea how badly I want to know a woman with twin inboard engines?
Bailey apologizes to Johnny. He tells her he had it coming, and somebody has to play editorials when they aren't supposed to.
Dive in when they have no idea how deep the water is. Throw caution to the winds. Take command of a situation when they have no concept of what's going on. Nessman can't carry the whole load himself.
Johnny tells Bailey he admires her for what she did, and then tells her he wants to ask her a question.
If I were to give you a pair of cut-off jeans, and I got a boat.
Anytime.
Looking up to the ceiling, Johnny says,
thank you, sir. I won't forget this one.
Johnny hugs Bailey.
Yeah, this relationship has hit a whole different stratosphere. I thought they were going to kiss. When they hugged,
it almost
looked like they were going to kiss.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Venus comes in from the studio hallway.
Hey, guys, at it again.
Venus walks across to the speaker on the wall, and he turns the volume up. He almost knocks it off the wall.
Yeah, I saw that.
We heard We're here. We hear Art talking.
I'd also like to say, too, that often my editorials are written by Bailey Quarters. Bailey Quarters is a woman. Although I have known two Baileys that were men. Anyhow, Bailey is the head of our Save the Flim Building campaign, and I want you to send your petitions and cards, letters, and remarks to her.
Bailey hurries out of the bullpen, headed to the studio. She quietly enters while Art is still speaking. Art finishes, stands up, and turns to see Bailey standing in the studio. He looks around and asks her, what do they do now? Bailey throws her arms around Art and gives him a big hug.
Well, I guess we'll just have some fun saving a building.
It is fun, isn't it?
The door to the studio opens and Venus comes running in, pushing past Bailey and Mr. Carlson. He rushes to the mic.
That preceding moment of silence was presented at a service to the hearing impaired listeners of ours. And this is Venus again, and I just like to say I'll be glad when all these white folks go home.
And we fade on I Am Woman, a fun episode, another Linda Day-directed episode. She can put a little bit of the heaviness in there, but then likes to have a lot of laughs. So what is up for next week?
Next week, we will be talking about Secret of Dayton Heights. Les is prepared to attend a presidential press conference, but finds that his credentials are being questioned. The Secret Service uncovered the fact that his biological father was a communist. This is one that's got some serious in it.
Yeah, I imagine. That's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. Find us on social media. You can follow our Facebook page at WKRPcast. For more WKRP fun, become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye, y'all.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!